From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook. When you think of art centers in the U.S., you probably immediately think of New York or L.A. It might be rare to think of Washington as a major player in the art world. But today, we're bringing you dispatches from D.C.'s burgeoning arts scene.
I had a twin sister who was like a straight A student. She was great at all of those subjects that it's good to be great at, like math and English. And, you know, she was like an A-plus student. And so if you think of yourself, I was a twin sister and I really wasn't terribly good at those subjects. So I think in the back of my mind, I had to find something that I felt comfortable with. So it was art for me.
You know, when I was presented with this opportunity, would you like to come to the Washington Ballet? Part of what I asked myself was, well, who else should do this? You know, is there someone else that knows more about dance or knows more about the community? And the answer was no.
We have interviews from two ladies paving the way for the arts in Washington. Melissa Chu, the director of D.C.'s Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden, and Julie Kent, the artistic director for the Washington Ballet. You may have seen Chu's work recently, even if you don't live in D.C. As the leader of Washington's Contemporary Art Museum, she's revolutionizing the way people consume modern visual art in the age of social media. Kent was, for years, a principal dancer at the American Ballet Theater in New York. But now she's devoting time to a different side of her art, leading a ballet troupe rather than dancing in it. And she's one of the few women in the U.S. to do so. Stay tuned for our interviews with Melissa Chu and Julie Kent. On the podcast, we'll be bringing you real talk with women bosses, asking how did you make it? What advice would you give a woman looking to lead? If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @apalmerdc. And subscribe to the Women Rule newsletter. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. First off, our interview with Melissa Chu. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today for our Washington Women in the Arts episode of the podcast. We are here with you at the Hirshhorn Museum, the Smithsonian's Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art. You are the director for the museum and sculpture garden, and you've curated some of the most impressive and popular exhibits that the Hirshhorn has ever had, including Kusama's impressive art installations that were a huge hit on social media and all over Washington. It was the thing that everyone talked about trying to figure out how to get in. I want to start there. The Kusama exhibit was clearly huge. The lines were at the door. Talk to us about how you think about modern art and how you decide what gets showcased here. What's the process like?
So thank you for having me on the podcast, Anna. I think that, you know, one of the most often asked questions, especially for modern contemporary art museums, is how we make decisions about which artists we show. And obviously, it's a commitment that the museum makes because the whole institution gets behind that artist. We're thinking about how artists respond to this moment in time that we live, and then what are they trying to tell us or show us about the future? And with that in mind, we might look to a younger generation of artists, mm-hmm. or artists who work with new technology. But equally so, we're focused on the last 100 years of artists who may well have been overlooked because their work didn't fit into perceptions of what art should be at the time. And casting our eye back to the 20th century, there are some of those artists like Kusama who actually were creating work that was very ahead of its time and kind of connects with today, mm-hmm. in a very different way.
You also really placed an emphasis on showcasing women artists, which hasn't always been a feature of the museum before. Since then, half of your single artist shows have been women. Why do you think women haven't been featured in that way before? And did you take a real strategic position to say, this is something that's important that we want to do here?
Yeah. So I think women have always been featured here at the Hirshhorn, but in different ways. And I think the shift that we've made consciously is to give major solo shows to them. I think we had a very active what we called our Directions Program, which was a single project focus. And if you look at the history of that, there are a lot of women artists included in that. But if you look at the major solo survey shows, what we would ordinarily devote our entire floor of the museum to, then there were less female artists. And so we've made a conscious decision to say, okay, who are those artists who happen to be women who are creating important works at this moment in time and who have a body of work? I think most importantly for those big shows, you need at least 15 years behind you to be able to show a particular development or narrative. And so we've been doing that. And one of the obviously, Kusama is probably the best example of that, because here is an octogenarian artist who really, in her time when she was living in New York in the 50s, didn't receive as much attention as her male peers. And there were lots of reasons for that. But we gave her then the survey show with a specific focus on her Infinity Mirror Rooms.
Let's take a step back and talk a little bit about your background, how you got to be director of the Smithsonian Institution. You're from Darwin, Australia, and you've
people always love to say that. I think it sounds exotic, doesn't it?
It does.
And much more exotic than Sydney, perhaps.
Talk to us about what that was like, how it impacted you, how you grew up and kind of made this decision to be in the art world.
Yeah, so, you know, I often think that I was encouraged by my parents to pursue art, partly because, you know, we're all formed by our familial relationships. Mm-hmm. And I had a twin sister who was like a straight A student. She was great at all of those subjects that it's good to be great at, like math and English. And, you know, she was like an A-plus student. And so if you think of yourself, I was a twin sister and I really wasn't terribly good at those subjects. So I think in the back of my mind, I had to find something that I felt comfortable with. So it was art for me.
Were they artists? And were they interested in
art? No. I think that they were just happy for me to find something that I was vaguely good at, right? So it was more, you know, I mean, I think it probably as a child, it was more driven by that, that that as a twin, you're often compared, right, in terms of all developmental growth and like where you are. And she crawled first, walked first, was an A-plus student. So I kind of had to find my way in the world. And so art for me was kind of that. And so then I, you know, went off and studied art at college and did all of that. So it was kind of more defined in as much as my interest in art as that kind of initial, I think, familial relationship. Yeah.
Well, just to kind of break it down. So you have a PhD with a focus on experimental Chinese art. Then you were with the Asia Society in New York for 15 years, first as a curator and then as vice president of global arts and cultural programs. So you came from New York, a city that's like clearly the center of the art world. Most people don't think of Washington necessarily, although they are becoming more so to think of it as kind of a place for art. What was the shift like after being in New York to come down to DC?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think at a certain level, most jobs are the same. So I'm going to say that actually, you know, that the issues are very similar in some ways. It's just the location changes. And even though I was in New York, I traveled much of my time and spent time programming in other places, whether it was Hong Kong or Houston or New York, and then developing shows, you know, internationally. Mm-hmm. So for me to come to DC, I was interested in a city that was the national capital. And because of that, had most of the national museums. So I kind of think of DC as the museum capital. Mm-hmm. And that, yes, people often say that it's not an art center, but in a way, if you're interested in museums, there is a certain degree of museum centrality here mm-hmm. in the city.
Yes, so talk about that. I mean, you really changed the outlook of the museum and what it offers to the public before you came in 2014. The Hirschhorn was struggling with financing, morale among kind of the staff and the public was pretty low. You have basically done a total turnaround in that. Your fundraising is up by 75%. And like we mentioned, you know, we've talked a little bit about this Kusama exhibit, the museum's attendance has hit record highs. What are some of the secrets to the success that you've brought to kind of reinvigorate things here?
I think with all of these markers of success and accomplishments, I think it's a combination of factors. And I do think that the Hirshhorn has benefited greatly from a consciousness about contemporary and visual arts out there in the wider world. You know, for a long time, people thought of contemporary art museums as those for the few, right? As not being very accessible, not really being interested in visitors. And I think that something changed. It changed locally and also internationally. So on the one hand, we have, especially younger generation, I would say, of visitors who are interested in museums as experiences. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other thing that never happened before. You know, that they, that these younger visitors, they often refer to them as millennials, but they're of a younger demographic who come to museums for experiences that they share with their friends on social media or they go to with friends. That social element really didn't exist in the same way before. So the Hirshhorn has directly benefited from that. And then the other thing that happened was that this idea of collecting contemporary art became a global phenomenon, mm-hmm. that there are now collectors around the world who not only are actively collecting contemporary art, but they are also building their own private museums. And so in an interesting way, the Hirshhorn as the National Museum of Modern Art is able to be something of a central force within those changes. And then internally, I think that we've been more focused on what it means to be a National Museum of Modern Art, that we've started to use this as a way of saying, okay, how can we contribute to a national dialogue? Which artists are making statements today through their art that are important for us to take account of, for us to either collect or exhibit? And so they're the kind of changing circumstances, I think.
And talk a little bit, I mean, you did have some criticism when you first started on the Washington art scene about doing fundraisers outside of Washington, using a curator at large who was based out of New York. People didn't take that too well. Have you won your critics over? How did you take that criticism? Often, we talk a lot on the podcast about women, that we struggle with these kinds of things where you're breaking barriers, but then you're also kind of being criticized inwardly and outwardly by a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, with all new jobs, I think that there's an internal and an external push and pull. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the challenges I had was that there were a lot of things that happened before I was appointed that were, in a way, legacy issues that we had to solve fairly quickly. And one of the real issues that was probably the most important for all nonprofits, which was the finances. Right. And so, you know, one of the ways that I had always raised funds for my past museums was events and galas, because mm-hmm. it was a way of mobilizing a community of support very quickly. And so that some of the criticism was directed towards a gala. We had had a gala already in DC, and then we decided to do a gala in New York. And so some of the criticism directed towards us was about having the gala in New York. In my mind, it was about raising much-needed funds for the Hirshhorn to operate here in D.C. You know, when Kusama came here in D.C., I think that there was a lot of excitement and now momentum behind it. And so there's, I think if you look back now with hindsight, there's probably a better understanding of what we were trying to do right out of the gate. Yeah.
And talk about that. So, I mean, talk about like taking Instagram and social media and using that for your experiences and looking at what's happened socially around the world. Clearly, the Me Too movement has impacted how different industries are dealing with it, from journalism, what we're doing, to the art world. What's your take on that? Have you guys done anything kind of directed at any exhibitions about that?
I think for us, this moment is an interesting one because we kind of see a similarity between this moment in time and what happened in the early 1990s, where there is an emergent sense of, or a new sense of, an identity politic. And I think the Me Too movement is one part of that, where we hear from previously marginalized voices. And in the art world, we also see new artists who are Black artists, Asian American artists. You know, the Me Too movement is not a singular movement. In a way, we're seeing it within art practices emerge to be a great sense of kind of diverse voices that we may not have heard of in great numbers before.
And when it comes to the future, and you kind of look at Washington now as this national kind of, you described it, the capital of all the museums. How do you see the Hirshhorn interacting with so many of the other art museums and different kind of overall arts community?
So I think for us, you know, we're in a museum that's always had ideas of collaboration at the center of what we do. And we're very excited by the idea of collaborating with other museums across the city. We've already done it with a number, not just Smithsonian institutions, but others like the Phillips in the last couple of years. And so we're looking forward to that. I think we're also very mindful of the Hirshhorn's role within the city on the one hand, and then also nationally and internationally. So on the one hand, we might do a project out on the streets or with Union Market, as we did with Yoko Ono. Or we might also send our Kusama show on the road. Actually, it's still going. It's right now, it's at Cleveland Museum and then goes on to Atlanta. So it's like the longest tour ever for us. So, you know, we're kind of looking at that intersection between our local role here in Washington and then playing out nationally and internationally. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Anna.
And now we're shifting gears to our interview with Julie Kent of the Washington Ballet. Well, Julie, thanks so much for joining us. It's a very busy time for you. Talk to me a little bit about where you are right now. You've come back to Washington after many years away. You're kind of settling into your role leading the ballet here. What was your biggest surprise taking on this role?
I don't think I was surprised by too much, but I feel like some of the challenges have been greater than I anticipated they would be. I think part of what motivated me to take this role was the emotional decision was exactly being afraid of that change for somebody that had spent their entire professional life from age 16 to age 46 in one professional environment. It was my life and my work and my family all in one. So even the idea of leaving that was somewhat of a fear that I felt like I needed to address. And also as an example to my children to not be afraid of change. So I trust what I know about my art. And that's also, you know, when I was presented with this opportunity, would you like to come to the Washington Ballet? Part of what I asked myself was, well, who else should do this? You know, is there someone else that knows more about dance or is more prepared to serve this institution or knows more about the community? And I was asking these questions honestly because that's what you should ask. And the answer was no. I'm perfectly prepared and qualified to serve the institution and serve the art form and therefore serve the community based on what I have learned, what has been invested in me, and what has been the opportunities that have been given to me my entire career. So I think that kind of confidence about your knowledge of your work informs how you lead an institution.
You're one of the few women leading a ballet troupe in the U.S. You said in an interview I was reading earlier today that your image of a leader was someone who likes to tell people what to do.
Right.
And that didn't kind of fit who you are. How do you define a leader now, or how have you changed that definition?
Well, I think that needs to be discussed because I think especially when you're talking about a conversation about women leaders and developing women leaders, this idea that we're all bad AWS women, to me, is really not true. And I don't think that you need to feel like you have to put those shoes on to be that leader. I know there are bad AWS women out there, and I'm happy for them, and they should be true to themselves the way that I am true to myself. But this kind of image that we have of a leader should be that, a leader should be type A, a leader should be all over everybody's stuff, and what are you doing, what are you doing, what are you doing, instead of somebody who is leads with their own voice. And so you have so many young women, girls, who would be wonderful leaders, but they don't fit that kind of description that we are kind of propelling, putting forward about what that needs to be.
Many industries, from the media to Hollywood to politics, are kind of part of this Me Too movement that has been happening. The ballet hasn't been immune to this. I mean, are you surprised that this has been happening in your field?
Yes. As my husband said, we're sad that it has to be talked about, but if it has to be talked about, then you have to talk about it. What I feel like, context is everything, and it's very hard to recreate context of 30 years ago now. Yeah. And so that's a reality. And sometimes while there have been clearly injustices that have gone on for a long time, there are also things that sort of are being wrapped up in this big wave, and common sense is not having a voice in this equation. So it's sad, it's complicated, and so you don't want to in any way not give significance to incidences that are clearly unacceptable at any time, in any context, you know, that are illegal and, you know, potentially criminal behavior. But that's different than some of the other circumstances. And it's just, there's no sifter, there's no, it's sort of just, it's all happening. And that just feels knowing where steady ground is, terra firma is a bit unknown right now. So
yeah, there's a lot of shifting dynamics, certainly.
Well put. Shifting dynamics. I'm going to remember that.
What do you do in your role to make sure that this isn't happening here? Is there any safeguards you've put in place, or do you feel like this is mostly a look back 20, 30 years, like you're kind of were saying?
No, I think that anybody has to learn from this kind of environment. And of course, trust is key. Does it get more complicated the larger company you have? Yes. So when you're looking at 100 dancers, trying to make sure that every single one of them is considered and feeling invested in and feeling, I mean, that's a lot to ask of that one person at the top of the pyramid to be able to do every single day. And so, yes, you build staff around that that you hope has that same message. But as you know, anytime you go in a chain of command, you're not going to get it. There's a process of change along that link. So it's complicated, but we have a relatively small company, and Victor and I work, and our staff work very hard every day to develop that trust, and also the understanding that we have been dancers. There's not anything that they're experiencing that we haven't experienced before. We have had very long careers in dance, and we know exactly all the ups and downs and challenges and frustrations, and some of it you can't change, you can't protect, you just have to support and say, you know, this is what it is. I know what you're going through, and I'm here to support you, but I can't change it.
What tips do you have? I mean, you've faced so many public reviews, right? The good, I'm sure there were some that were hard to read or hear about. What tips do you have for women on how to take that kind of tough criticism?
Yeah. I mean, it's being a dancer, you have to have a lot of courage. You have to have the guts to put yourself on the line every day. I mean, that's what it is. But we train for it, and we start as young 8-9-year-olds standing in front of a mirror and examining how, not just what we're doing, but how we do it. That statement, it's not just what you do, but how you do it, is really important in life, not just in dance, but in everything, because it's that pursuit for the detail that differentiates good from great, or fine from wow, or I've seen it before, I've never seen that before. You know, that's the pursuit. And it can be very easily, unless you embrace it in the right way, a self-critical, I'll never be, blah, you know, a frustrating process, or it can be an inspiring process where you embrace the idea that what you're trying to achieve is not a finite process. There's no end to it. And actually, the reward is in the work. And yes, we have these moments, we have these goals, we have these performances. So we have these moments where this is it. And then the curtain comes down and it's over. There's no painting to hang on the wall. There's no replay. There's no broadcast. It's going to be broadcast week after next. It's done. And I shared it with you and you and you and everyone in the audience. And that's all we have. So the next morning you get up, you go to class, you stand at the bar, and you start all over again. And you just build on that last performance and you move forward. And that is an inspiring, artistic pursuit. And that is what I try to put in my message every day.
Well, thank you so much, Julie. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Women Rule is produced by Rena Flores. Dave Shaw is our executive producer, and our booker is Jessica Andrews. If you're a fan of the show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. We've got a ton of great guests coming up, so hit that subscribe button, and thanks for listening.